HPPodcraft.com.
Beaten back by fogs and blizzards of the heights, the Stamwell party was camped in a sun-warmed valley at the base of Mount Logan, which lifts its ice-capped head in eternal solitude and awful silence above the most intensely glaciated region of the world. 3 years before, in an attempt to follow McCarthy, who first ascended Logan, the intrepid mountain climber Morsi had fallen into a crevasse, and Professor Stamwell was now attempting to recover his body from the glacier, and, by a process of his own experimentation, restore it to life.
Help me, somebody, help me!
Morsi fell into a glacier!
No, Morsi, not Morrissey.
Oh, Morsi.
It's a different guy. That was the introduction to The Wolf Woman by Bassett Morgan.
We're closing out the Werewolves of Weird Tales with a story that's part vampire, part At the Mountains of Madness, part siren song of the Odyssey. Not really that werewolfy, but we're doing it here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We are exclusively on Patreon.
Aroo, was that reader?
Our reader is Sean Burnham, back again after a long hiatus. I think it was back in April when we had him on last. He's a great reader. He's also known as the sensual John Dingo. So you should go check him out on his Patreon. John Dingo is a singer-songwriter influenced by They Might Be Giants, The Decemberists, Frank Portman, The Mountain Goats, and many others.
Undoubtedly the March Draculas.
And he'd like to share his music and songwriting adventures with anyone who's willing to follow along. So please go check him out on Patreon. If you hear this reading and you think, oh my God, this guy's voice is great, you should hear him sing.
His pseudonym is John Dingo, the sensual part you were adding. That's a little editorial.
It's true.
It is true. It's appropriate we'd have a reader with a pseudonym because that's also the case with this writer that wrote the story we're covering today, right?
That is correct. Bassett Morgan is a pen name. Her real name is Grace Jones Morgan. Grace Jones!
That's right.
Bassett was her father's middle name.
The source I have, her name is actually Grace Ethel. Ethel is her middle name. Grace Jones is her real name. Morgan was her husband's name that she took. By the way, Grace Jones, star of the movie Vamp.
True.
Another vamp. You know, this morning I washed my face and I looked up into the mirror and I was like, man, you've been hitting the Draculas hard this year. Marches for Draculas is next month.
Yeah.
We've already had a lot of Draculas. We pre-gamed Marches for Draculas this year really hard.
Really did.
But back to Bassett Morgan.
She was Canadian, born in 1884. Chatham in Ontario, married in 1905. Moved to California in 1918.
Later in life, she published as Grace Jones Morgan. Her 13 stories in Weird Tales between 1926 and 36 were all as Bassett Morgan.
She wrote for a lot of pulps, Argosy, Oriental stories, and ghost stories. Most of her writing, however, was non-weird. She wrote for lots of magazines, including Boy's Life. I had a subscription to that when I was a kid. Women's Journal, and a ton of others that I'm not going to list.
Yeah, like probably things like Girl's Notebook, Dog's Diary. I see a pattern.
In 1974, she published her father's autobiography, The Recollections of Edwin Gassett Jones, which focuses on his amateur archaeological work, including his finds of Native American artifacts and a mastodon.
Oh.
Oh, so it ties in with this story.
Yeah, it ties into the fantasy family I had when I was mad at my parents, too. They were amateur archaeologists. Always going off on trips, leaving me money for pizza, letting me do whatever I wanted, bringing back enchanted masks.
Oh, wow.
They were great.
She published three novels, Salvage All, 1928, Tents of Shem, 1930, and The Golden Rupee in 1935. She died in Alameda in 1977 at the age of 92.
92, wow. The Dark Worlds quarterly article that we used to find these weird tale stories also had a specific article about this story by G.W. Thomas, and it referred to the story as a northern, which maybe we've talked about that as a genre on the show before because we have done northerns, but it felt like the first time I thought of it as a genre was hearing about it here.
Yeah,
it says
yeah.
The first modern western is considered to be Owen Wister's The Virginian from 1902, and that's the prototype for that genre. The northern, being a similar kind of story, is set in the north, usually Alaska or Canada, and features such icons as Mounties, dog sleds, lumberjacks, gold miners, Native Americans, animals like wolves, bears, and caribou, and it thrived during a similar time period. market as the original Westerns. It was just a subgenre that never managed to become the massive category of storytelling that the Western became. Hmm. I would guess that that has a lot to do with that it's very difficult to shoot in snow and in the winter. Exactly. It's a lot easier to shoot in the desert, so that's why the Western was ascendant. But this is a strange Northern, you might even say a spicy Northern, certain aspects of it. We've certainly done a lot of frozen in the ice stories, and I always kind of thought of them as inspired by the Arctic exploration that was going on maybe a generation before, but really seen from this perspective as a Northern, it's just another setting, right? Like the Old West or feudal Japan or Star Wars. Mm. We happen to read horror stories, so that's always our exposure to the Northern, but you could tell a love story there or a dog story. For example, The Wolf Woman, which is kind of both. Now, it got the cover of this issue of Weird Tales, which was September 1927. The cover is by C.C. Senf. That is Curtis Charles Senf, S-E-N-F. And I realize I foolishly have not been crediting these artists when I mentioned them.
Oh, my God.
The Werewolf of Ponker cover art that we liked at the top of the month was by Andrew Brosnach. But this cover, it's a naked white woman with long, long blonde hair. And it's really suggestive of The Birth of Venus, the Botticelli painting, except the hair in the Botticelli painting, she's pushing it all the right places. And on this cover, the hair's doing it all on its own. And she's not pushing it into place. In fact, she's holding her arms out like, look at me, you know. And the expression on her face is sort of funny from a modern lens because it just looks generically friendly. But I've consumed so much 1920 stuff that I recognize it is very lurid. It's the bad flapper look. It's the smoky eyes inviting. You know, she's got these three giant ravenous wolves leaping at her command, it seems, toward a pulp hero who's whipping around with a gun. He's got this scarf or bandana around his neck that's showing the motion.
Our story begins with these two white guys, Professor Stamwell and his assistant, Lieutenant Cressy. They're out looking for a lost guy, Morsi, out in the wilds of Canada. He has been gone for a long time, and they think that he probably froze to death, but Professor Stamwell has discovered what he believes to be a new way of bringing frozen people back to life. And that sounds like a pretty solid, pulpy beginning of a story there.
It's great. Usually someone goes out, gets lost, then we follow the expedition to find them. But this one goes a step further. They're getting the guy from that second failed expedition, and they're going to try and reanimate him. So it's wolf pregnant with wolf possibility.
Their expedition is guided by the half French, half indigenous person, but he's Canadian, Baptiste. Mm-hmm. They write all of his speech phonetically, and honestly, that's pretty entertaining because it's wacky French, you know, like, oh, mes chéris. Yeah, yeah. And I did find myself reading it out loud to get the effect of the phonetic writing.
Of course. And I'm sure there was some phonetic writing with Jules de Grandin in our last story, but I'm sure you didn't read that out loud.
No.
Right? Because it struck me that in the Northern, this is the one genre where if you have a French accent, you're the tough guy. Normally, if you have a French accent, you're more like de Grandin, where you're snobby or affected. But here, if you've got the French Cajun thing going, that means you're salt of the earth and you know what's going down. You probably got some good skills.
That's true. Now, Baptiste comes into the camp and says, hey, guys, I met this dude who lives out in the woods and he makes these awesome ivory carvings. You gotta check these out. And the professor and Cressy, they're like, hey, okay, sure, why not? So they traipse out to this cabin in the woods and it's owned by this guy named Joe. His name is Joe. He is half Indian, half Eskimo.
This eventually would become a port for Alaska cruise ships, this area. They have ivory carving shops everywhere in those port towns in Alaska, Juneau and Skagway.
Right.
Heather, I think we were doing the show back then. She was touring on one of those in the Second City show. Mm-hmm. And so I went on those ports. And the thing I found so odd about it was that it's odd to go to a place and then go to the chain store version of the place in that place.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard the Black Forest is like that in Germany a little bit, where the town is so overpopulated with tourists and tourist attractions.
Oh, wow.
Where they're like, we are so German here. Look at our Lederhosen and our beer. You know, it's all that Epcot Center.
Right.
Tourist Germany. And it's like you've gone all the way to the Black Forest and then you're getting something that you could get, a caricature that you could get anywhere.
Sure.
The same stores that might have a pewter wizard contemplating an orb would likely also have some ivory carvings of bears and wolves and whatnot. So this guy Joe is the prototype of that type of shop.
You know, there's one of those places at our local market here in Keithley. It's got three wolf moon and those types of things and pewter wizards and all that stuff. And I so badly want to just buy something for Rachel as a joke, but I think she would be mad at me for doing it, wasting money on a thing that she obviously wouldn't really like, but it would bring me so much joy.
Oh, it really would. But see, that's an extra level to the joke, though, because then you'd be kind of hurt. She could, wait a minute, did he really? I mean, I guess I was saying it was a joke because I was embarrassed. I was hoping you'd go, this isn't a joke. I love it. But now, you know, and I was nervous. Well, I guess I know where we stand now.
It's giving me more fuel.
You're just on a street corner. Your only possession is the pewter wizard. Stick it out of a bundle on a stick. I don't know why it's funny to me now. You have a bundle and a stick with a wizard sticking out of it, and you're hitchhiking in Yorkshire.
That sad Incredible Hulk music is playing. Now, Joe is cool. He's totally friendly and has all these dope sculptures, but one of them is insane. It's of an amazingly beautiful white woman. She's not a native person. She's obviously white, the way her bone structure is. She's lying down, seemingly asleep, and they're just totally blown away by it because it's almost full size. And I got two questions. One, where did you find a piece of ivory this big? And two, who inspired the sculpture?
The ivory itself is odd. Professor Stamwell says it's different from the other smaller sculptures, that ivory. It's almost like it's fossilized. The part with it being a white woman, this is like a more plausible version of what we had in The Shining Pyramid by Mackin, when the character was like, no child from here could possibly draw the shape of an Asian person's eye. Right. Here, the fact that he's carved a European white woman in every fine detail absolutely doesn't make sense, unless some kind of white chicks Eskimo situation broke out, which we don't know about that.
No.
But I don't think so. It's clear Joe is an excellent craftsman, but they can also see he's a human 3D printer and that he needs a model. His other creations are all copies or imitations from life. Right. So a little bit of a Pickman's model element right here, too.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. There's no way he didn't carve this without actually seeing it.
Baptiste translates this for Joe, and Joe explains that the ivory is from a mammoth body that came out of the ice, and the woman is actually still frozen in the ice. And I'm like, what? And he says, yeah, the woman's been frozen there for like over 100 years. Like, we all know about it.
He calls the mammoth a land whale. That's what Joe calls it.
They asked Joe to take them to go see this mammoth and this woman frozen in the ice, and yeah, he's totally up for it. So he takes them up the mountain into this cave, and there is frozen in the ice this blonde woman and also seven large wolves, huge wolves.
Yeah.
And then further in the cave, they can smell the rotting corpse of the mammoth.
The woman is beautiful. And because he's a man of science, Stamwell wants to thaw her out because scientists forget their objectives very quickly. We saw this in Manimal when he wanted to just suddenly taxidermy that living panther. They just lose sight of what they want to do. Cressy says, what about this mammoth? My God. And Stamwell's like, mammoths are everywhere. Forget about it. These are OG pure wolves like this don't exist anymore. And this lady, she's pretty special. I'm going to use this reanimating process I was going to use on Morrissey or whomever that was. And the fact that we can even see them means that this ice is melting.
Yeah.
One more summer comes, they're going to be exposed to air soon and they're all going to be destroyed anyway. So we might as well
give it a go.
Do a weird science.
So Cressy reluctantly agrees to this. They chip out the bodies and the locals are not really cool with this, including Baptiste, but no one's going to stop them, so they're just going to keep their distance. They're fuzzy about the details of this process, but it starts with a slow heating and then some chemicals and herbs and then a meat broth. But a first thing that they're going to try it on is one of the wolves, and it works. The wolf is alive.
And the lady is special, as I said, so they want to start with those wolves. They want to get everything right. If something goes wrong, kill a wolf before you kill this woman. And that broth was a good trick. It just keeps saying they applied his processes. I was thinking, what are these processes? And then they go, and then they served him some broth. And I thought, that sounds pretty good. Cold out like that? Yeah, I can see. They were reanimated with broth. I get it.
The wolf, when it comes to life, is weak, but it gets better every day. They decide to try it again and again. And eventually all the wolves are up and about. They say those wolves are 11 feet long from nose to tail. That's insanely huge. A horse is 8 feet long.
Yeah.
So either the writer is exaggerating or these wolves are bigger than horses.
I think they are bigger than horses. They're like dire wolves in Game of Thrones. But it really makes me laugh that you say, I think this writer is exaggerating. This can't be what factually happened. But that is an insane, if you think about that.
Dire wolves are big. I've seen skeletons of dire wolves. They're not the size of horses, though. They're not that big.
No, but the ones in the Game of Thrones are.
Oh, okay.
They're called dire wolves, but they're more like this. Sure.
Now, everyone in the camp is afraid of them, including the other dogs, but they chain up these giant wolves and they kept them fed. Since all seems to be working, they decide it's time to ride it on this woman, and it works. Her eyes flutter open and they're violet, but she goes back to sleep. Stamwell is stoked. He just brought someone back from the dead.
While the woman sleeps, Cressy is in charge of watching over her. She opens her eyes and she looks like she needs something. At first, he thinks it's his coffee, but he gives her some of the magic broth instead. She is ravenous and he touches her long, long hair. She gets this kind of throaty laugh. It's almost sophisticated.
Mm.
Kathleen Turner thing going on here. She nuzzles up to him and her origin story's like Captain America, but she's pulling a Batman. I'm talking about Chad Pfeiffer's Batman. She's drinking his blood.
She is. It doesn't hurt and it feels kind of good, but he's a bit freaked out by the whole thing. And he's not sure what to do. Stamwell wakes up just in time and sees this and is able to free Cressy from her. He holds her down and he tells Cressy, get me a hypo because she's strong and I'm having trouble holding her. And so he does. Now, Stamwell chews out Cressy for not watching her properly while he tends to Cressy's neck wound. Soon after, Baptiste comes in and says the wolves are too big to keep. They're going to break out of their chains or break the trees that the chains are tied to, you know, because they're that freaking big.
They just didn't really have a good game plan for after bringing them back to life in terms of what they were going to do with these things.
Not at all.
Also, they don't talk at all about how Cressy almost got vamped. I think that the scientist just thinks he's lazy and stupid or, just wanted to hug the reanimated body or something. Most of it was subjective. I mean, in that Cressy's the only one who experienced it. And I think he's under the spell, so he's not going to tell anybody about it.
No.
But it was so odd that she blood drunked him. He's just like, oh, let's just all go to bed.
Well, Stamwell is tending to his wound. So he knows this woman, Cressy, on the neck. And yet he's just like, oh, well. So maybe he's also under her spell as well.
Perhaps.
The next day, Cressy and Baptiste go back to the cave to get the other tusk from the dead mammoth. But Cressy slips and he breaks his leg. They set up camp. Some of the guys go to take the tusk to Joe. And when they come back, they tell Cressy that Joe says that the devil wolves and the devil woman are no good. And no good is going to come of this. But Baptiste, he's like, he's probably right, that Joe, he knows things. So Baptiste goes back to check on Stamwell at the main camp. But later that night, Baptiste comes back and says that Stamwell is dead and drained of blood. The blonde woman is gone, nude out in the wilds.
The devil woman, the devil wolves. I think they're no good. He's probably right, Makes sense to me. That's not quite how it went, but I really like that version of it. Now, Cressy must feel somewhat responsible for Stamwell being dead and drained of blood. Does he even tell him?
He didn't. But he must have known because he tended his wound.
He knows that something happened. Maybe he thought he was feeding her and she, being this primitive wolf woman.
Yeah, well.
Bit him. He didn't say, I got hypnotized.
No.
Would have sounded kind of silly.
Did he know he got hypnotized? Because he wouldn't necessarily know he was hypnotized.
I think he knows he was first level hypnotized and that his, he wasn't doing anything while he was getting blood drunk.
Right.
But he didn't know he was next level hypnotized where he would convince himself not to say anything.
That makes sense. With this news, Baptiste says, we're not staying here. We and the boys, we're all going to go stay in Joe's cabin tonight.
Uh-oh, I smell a werewolf siege. Werewolf stories do tend to go there.
It happens.
At some point.
So after they move all their stuff into Joe's, Cressy is saying, we got to find that woman. She's all naked out there and helpless. But Baptiste, he knows what's up.
Baptiste tells Cressy, you're under some kind of spell. I'm not letting you out of the cabin.
And there's eight men part of this expedition that are in this cabin with them. And they're barring the door and they could hear the howling, but still Cressy wants to go out. So outside they see the woman walking out in the cold with the white wolves. And they run to her and they circle and they jump around her. They're so happy to see her. And the woman, she calls. I don't know if it's a literal call or if it's a mental suggestion kind of call to Cressy. He fights to go outside, but Baptiste takes out a small silver cross and places it on Cressy's head, and it causes him pain. Baptiste then places the cross around Cressy's neck and says some prayers over him.
If this were Spicy Weird Tales, there would have been a lot more detail about the woman walking around in the cold.
Oh, yeah.
The funny thing is that would be where I think it would be cool and acceptable because she's running her wolf pack and she likes being naked. It's not like she's knocked out and everybody's getting a glimpse,
And it's cold, too, which is really unnatural. So she's out there nude in the cold, very comfortable. They say she's nude at one point and then they never mention it again. So it's kind of anti-spicy.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Finally, you have a justified spicy situation. Right. No spice. So every night the pack, the siege starts, right? The pack comes to Joe's cabin. The men are locked inside. Cressy is drawn to the woman's call. It's only Baptiste's crucifix pressed hard on his face and his heart that keep him from going out there.
Yeah. Cressy, he says he wants revenge against this woman, seemingly forgetting his lovey feelings for her from the other night. But he thinks that he might know where she is. And with a few men, he goes up into the mountain. He finds some of her hair as they climb, and it says,
he saw something glittering over a flower that seemed withered in first unfolding. And he picked from it a long, glistening thread of golden hair that curled by some attraction of warm blood around his fingers.
Oh, now that's That's cool. That is creepy.
Yeah, that's really cool.
He goes into this cave and then out charge the wolves. And Cressy fires his gun at the wolves, but it seems to have no effect. And he thinks, oh, I'm dead. But the wolves, they just blast past him and out to the men that he brought with him. And he can't see it because he's deeper in the cave, but he hears the growls and the screams of the men as the wolves rip them apart. And he just stands there in fear. And at that, the woman comes to him from inside the cave and she opens her arms to him. And he shields his eyes not to look at her because he's so attracted to her and drawn to her, but he can't help it. He looks at her and so he moves to her, but then she backs away from him. And it's the cross around his neck. She can't get close to him. So she calls the wolves and then they all escape.
I wonder why the cross has power in this instance. I guess it is God intervening on your behalf.
It's holy. It's good.
But it doesn't matter whether you have faith in it or not.
No.
You can just put a cross up and it'll defend. Because even the wolves are afraid of these crosses.
Yeah, yeah.
I just find that interesting because sometimes it's God's running a protection racket. You know, when it's you have to have faith for that to work. Meaning, unless you got to scratch my back before I scratch yours, which I always find interesting. And we're going to talk about that stuff a lot during I Am Legend, actually. Because there are theories about the cross and why it works on vampires. It gets pretty complex in that. But Cressy goes back to the camp and he tells Baptiste that the men that were with him are dead, killed by the wolves. So they hunker down in the cabin for 3 days waiting for some men to return with help, which, you know, eventually arrives. This guy Johnson with his own expedition. Cressy doesn't beat around the bush. He tells Johnson everything. Due to the situation and its seriousness, Johnson actually believes Cressy that this all went down, which is nice. You know?
He goes, we don't have to deal with like, you're kidding me. That's ridiculous kind of BS. He's like, nope, I buy it. The men, they make a fence of crosses around the cabin to ward off the woman and the wolves. But Cressy, he says he really wants to kill the woman, but does he? Because secretly what he wants is to hug and kiss her. So they go up to the cave during the day and inside they find a frozen mammoth in the ice. Not the one that was partially unfrozen that he was getting, another one.
Yeah.
Johnson, he goes nuts with this discovery. He says, we must use Stamwell's method and bring this mammoth to life. And Cressy's going, what are you talking? Like, that's crazy. Oh, I bet you he's under the spell of the wolf woman. Maybe she wants this to happen. I don't know, but I don't care, really. I want some nuzzling. And maybe this mammoth will keep Johnson busy. Sure, and if she wants it, maybe I should be doing it too. So he helps with the mammoth resurrection. Now, Baptiste, he doesn't want any part of this. And good old Joe is taking that other mammoth tusk and making another sculpture of the woman. This time she'll be standing. And he believes that when he's done, the sculpture will be like a voodoo doll. They can use sympathetic magic to defeat her since bullets aren't working on these things.
Joe is the coolest. And he's really actually the pulp hero or the occult detective.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's not an occult detective. He's more of, you know, he's just trying to run a souvenir shop, but he has to keep solving occult matters in this part of the North. He surmises the situation and he is the exact solution. And he's just going to get to working on it. Although the thing I like about him is he really doesn't care about anybody else. He doesn't try to convince them that he's right.
No.
He just says, you guys do whatever. I'm going to carve this woman over here. It's how we solve everything, guys. But, oh, you're not interested? Okay, go ahead. Reanimate that mammoth. Yeah. Whatever.
Do whatever you're going to do. I'm going to stick to this because I know it's going to work and save everybody's ass. So these walls of crosses that they built around the cabin, come nightfall, they totally work against the wolves and the woman. They can't get past them and they can't destroy them. After a day or two of work, they get the mammoth out of the ice and begin to resuscitated. It works, of course. Mm-hmm. The mammoth comes to life, and then everybody immediately understands that it was a bad idea because this giant beast almost crushes everyone.
I have to say that this is when the story rocketed to awesomeness for me. Because when they left the mammoth behind earlier, I was a little disappointed too.
Oh, yeah.
That it comes back into play at this point was great. Mm-hmm. And also just the no post plan, once again. Let's just get it up and running, and then we'll deal with whatever happens at that point.
But by doing this, it somehow freed Cressy of the spell that he was under. And he goes to Baptiste and he goes, dude, I think I'm actually over this woman. And then Baptiste takes him, looks into his eye, and he goes, oh yeah, I don't see the image of the woman in your eyes anymore. And Cressy's like, what? You could see an actual image of the woman in my eyes?
I wonder if it was a spiritual thing he's talking about or if you really could. That would be a pretty interesting way to diagnose this Lucy's disease, I guess you'd call it, you know, being under the spell of a vampire. Would be terrible if people could see whatever you were under the spell of in your eyes just in normal life.
Yeah.
Especially because you'd wish it was scandalous or something, but it would just be like a piece of pie.
This is a bit of a spoiler. Not a spoiler here, but this is kind of the elephant in the room. I hate bringing this up right now, but this is not really a werewolf story. She's a vampire.
As a matter of fact, it's not even described as a werewolf story. So it's in this Werewolf of Weird Tales thing, and they're wolves.
Yeah.
She's a master of wolves.
Sure.
In the contents of the Weird Tales, it says they dug her out of a glacier, this golden-haired vampire of the north.
Yeah.
She called the white wolves to her bidding. And then in the Eerie, which is their sort of letters part, there's a note from Farnsworth in there, and it right away says, the wolf woman is a vampire tale.
Yeah.
And moreover, it is a vampire tale with a distinctly new and original plot. So in this one instance, maybe the Dark Worlds Quarterly article steered us wrong. It's not quite a werewolf story, but at the same time, it's very enjoyable.
Or it's just kind of easing us into Marches for Draculas.
It's a good transition. Actually, it's a quite appropriate transition, because something that I never knew about, because I was just reading the book in Iron Legend, is that it does have some ancient origins like this, the vampire disease, that are kind of similar, which obviously we'll talk about on those episodes. Yes. But this has a very definite tie-in with that, so it is a good transition.
Now, Cressy and Johnson finally see the sculpture that Joe's been working on. It's not finished yet, but it is as alluring as the original woman. And Johnson tries to buy it from Joe. Yeah, but Joe's not selling it because he knows what's up.
Yeah. Night comes, they hear the wolves, and the woman is with them. They stop at the wall of crosses, but Johnson, he slipped out. Mm. He's got to have it. They see him go to her. She embraces him. Cressy jumps out to rescue him. The wolves don't attack him because of the cross he's wearing. And as he's able to get closer, the woman moves away. So he's able to pull Johnson back, sort of becoming his wolf woman sponsor at this point.
Right. But then they hear this sound crashing through the woods, and it's the mammoth. And I think, whoa, it's going to be a big battle. This mammoth's going to, maybe this is the good mammoth and it's going to like totally wreck her and stuff. Nope. The mammoth shows up and he picks her up with his trunk, which I think, oh, okay, he's going to crush her. No, he does not crush her. He places her on his back.
Yep.
It is an evil mammoth. And then they all run off in the woods together.
This is probably while you were reading this, you were going, man, he said all these werewolf stories were so good this month. I mean, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
This is the part where I went, yep. This is great because it is a Dracula.
Yeah.
But think about this Dracula. We never had a Dracula like this before. Over here, we've got a guy in a tux with the, you know, he's got some brides, a ladle, because he's been cooking for his guests. Over here, Lady Godiva on a mammoth with a pack of horse-sized wolves.
Yeah. It's pretty badass. Now, Johnson is pissed when he comes around because he, you know, he wants to be doing the hugging and the kissing. Cressy takes off the cross and he puts it around Johnson's neck and he screams in agony. So Cressy knows what Johnson's going through because he went through it as well. Another day passes and the sculpture is now complete. Johnson really wants it and he offers Joe some more money, but then Joe's like, dude, sit down and get out of my hair, okay? This ain't for you.
Well, Johnson secretly slips his cross off.
Yes. So he's even more obsessed with hugging and a kissing. Mm-hmm. He's willing to take off the cross. That doesn't even bring him to his senses like it did with Cressy. Now, as midnight comes, they can hear the wolves and the mammoth come to the cabin. The woman is standing on the mammoth's back.
Yes.
Standing. Joe, just no big deal, walks out of the cabin. They talk about how just chill he is. Like, none of this is phasing him at all. Walks out of the cabin with the sculpture, ready to conduct occult investigator business. But Johnson, he blasts out of the cabin, grabs the sculpture of the woman, and then runs to the wall of crosses with it. The woman, she grabs Johnson, embraces him, and then he drops the sculpture onto the ground near the mammoth. She begins to drink his blood, and the mammoth gets all excited about the blood and the gory things, stops around. And when he stops around, he crushes the statue.
Even she didn't have a plan for the post-mammoth reanimation.
No.
Then, as if at a signal, the ghost beasts seemed frozen in their tracks. And from them came a glistening white mist, which swayed to and fro as it rose and drifted across the face of the young moon. And the watchers saw, like a frail cloud, the shining form of that lovely, hell-born huntress as it blew away on the wind of dawn. The light grew swiftly. The sun came up and shone on the mountainous mass of hairy mammoth flesh and long-furred hounds lying on the tundra. As they stood, chained to the spot by paralysis of horror, every nerve taut, the men at the cabin saw that mound of flesh subside to pulp, and a dreadful stench arose in a smoky steam. By noon, there was a gelatinous mass, which by nightfall had soaked into the earth, leaving only the skeletons. A clean, cold wind from the snows sweetened the air where Joe prodded the bones with a stick to recover all that was left of his ivory huntress, a bead on which the features faithfully depicted her inscrutable smile, with lips and teeth slightly parted.
It says after that that Cressy didn't want anything to do with that face of the sculpture afterwards because it reminded him of that feeling of wanting to hug and kiss the wolf woman. And they never found her body. So she didn't like melt like the wolf and the wolves and the mammoth did. So no. Maybe she's still out there.
Monsieur, said Baptiste, that devil woman have drank your blood one time. And if someday she come back, she catch you again. Because all woman is jealous. And if womans get jealous, it open doors of very bad hells. You do what Baptiste say. You wear a little crucifix all time.
And though not a religious man, Cressy has never since been without that symbol.
I mean, I would think more like vengeance or jealous. He's saying if she comes back, finds out you have a girlfriend, it's going to be a Batman situation when you get mad about Alice.
Yeah, you know, that's the end of the story. I think it's kind of cool because I seem to remember that idea from other stories, or maybe it was Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game, mm-hmm. where these European vampires came over during the Leif Erikson period, you know, like when the Vikings were coming over to North America, worshipped by like the native people or thought to be devils by the native people. And this all kind of predates that by 50 or 60 years, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat. It's a neat idea.
Also, I'm goofing. Jealousy actually is the appropriate thing because there's this bond between them. So if she were to resume or if she were to find him again, she would be mad because he's like, you know, it's the hugging and the kissing, like you said. That's their bond.
They want to do the hugging.
Well, overall, I really enjoyed this story.
Me too. Yeah, I think it was really cool. And not a werewolf story, but like I said, it's easing us into Marches for Draculas, and that's what we need.
And I think it also shows how often your greatest asset can also be the thing that destroys you, as in the mammoth.
Right.
There's a message here.
You know, one of our greatest assets is our reader, Sean Burnham, a.k.a. the sensual John Dingo. Please check him out on Patreon. He's got some great music, and he's a very talented fella.
You know what? I also would like to thank some of our patrons. I'm going to start with a good friend of ours, Lee Candelino.
Oh, hey, Lee. Hey. I'd like to thank Frederick.
I'd like to thank Trevor G. Elliott.
Janine Chang, thank you so much.
Mike Robertson, thank you.
I'd like to thank Blake Hollifield.
I'd like to thank Sandy Nicholson.
Crestolium. Thank you.
Eric Sproka, thank you. Hey, Eric, what's up?
And lastly, I'd like to thank Tom Krabbacher.
That's all we've got for this month of Weird Werewolves. Hope you've enjoyed the ride, and we're going to be back with I Am Legend next month. I hope you'll all tune into that. For now, I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Still the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. We're here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.